Dr. Kramer finally said. There is no room for trust outside of this group. Trust needs to be hard won and certain before it is given. I want all of you to remember this. Well, Garrett concluded, after they looted everything and left the building, I went out toward the front of the store and heard them talking outside about your office. They wanted more drugs. So I got a couple of crowbars from the docking area and got here as fast as I could. There were only three of them, and by the time I got up here, two were in the building, and one stood by the car smoking a cigarette. He never heard me come up behind him. After seeing Mr. Wainwright killed by those sickos, it was terribly easy to smash the punk's head. I just wanted to make them pay for what they did, and I couldn't let anything happen to you guys. We sat in silence, considering what had just happened. Dr. Kramer, as usual, was the first to act. He stood up and faced us. Well, he started. Out of tragedy comes opportunity. We now have a functional car and supplies in the dumpster. It will be light in an hour or two, he continued. Charlie, you and I will go down to the dumpster after I inventory the stolen items in the car and retrieve the supplies. Then we can get the hell out of here. Nothing ever had sounded so good to my ears. Chapter 16, Day 6, John Drosky, South Orlando. Officer Drosky sat on the front porch of the one-story house. After finding the two bodies in the back bedroom, he spent the next few days helping those in the neighborhood cope with the new realities they faced. It was frustrating to watch civilization rapidly disappear. The two local gas and go shops were a total loss, having been broken into and vandalized the third night he slept. After the second night in the house, the smell from the back bedroom forced him to duct tape the door's seams. His food supplies, at least the ones he wasn't using in his emergency kit, were rapidly drawing to an end, and John felt he had done all he could with the limited resources he had at his disposal. He was throwing buckets of water on a forest fire. It was futile to do much more. It was time to make his way back to headquarters and check in with his superiors. The morning air was crisp and cold when John went back inside and gathered his backpack and supplies. He wore his civilian clothes, his police uniform stuffed in the backpack with the other items he was to carry. His Batman duty belt was on his waist with his SIG 226 holstered and a couple of spare magazines. He manufactured a sling for his shotgun, and it hung from his right shoulder. His patrol car still sat in front of the house as he closed the front door to the dead couple's home he had occupied the past 5 days. He had completed a final quick check for anything of value in both the house and his vehicle earlier, so he began the walk downtown. It shouldn't take too long, he thought to himself. It's less than 3 miles. He strode north to Colonial Drive and gazed right down the 6-lane road. Smoke still rose from the executive airport where a jumbo jet had tried to land. The pilot attempted to use the short runway to glide his beast to the ground, but in the end, there was too little real estate and too much mass to stop. It slammed into one of the numerous hangars that lined the runway and burst into flames. With no fire trucks or power, the wreckage created a series of smaller fuel fires that spread from hangar to hangar and plane to plane. By the third day, most of the buildings had been reduced to ashes. The only thing John could see as he started down the road was the Southwest emblem on the tail of the doomed jetliner. It was the only part of the jet to survive the inferno. The walk to the station was remarkably serene. John always liked early starts, and with the sunrise at his back, as he made his way west towards downtown, it gave the city a lightness that belied the reality of the situation. As he approached the downtown area and its blocks of high-rise office buildings and condominiums, vandalism was starting to show itself. Every store that could have held something of value had been broken into and ransacked. Another gas station at the corner of Orange and Colonial was gutted and burned. A pharmacy and local sandwich shop also suffered similar fates. Checking down one small side street, John saw a body on the grass of a renovated home. The early 1900s brick mansion had been converted into an attorney's office. The lawn was littered with trash, and as John hustled down the street to check the victim, he quickly realized she was beyond help. Her clothing ripped from her body, a knife buried in her chest. The poor woman had been sexually brutalized and killed where she laid. John made his way up to her body. He moved her lifeless form to the flower bed next to the broken-out front door of the mansion. John retrieved his sidearm and entered the house. Once he was inside and confirmed a lack of occupants, he brought the body into the old house and laid her on a couch in a reception room to the right of the front entrance. He covered her form with a blanket from a closet in the hallway. After finding no identification, he said a quick prayer and went back on his way. A few minutes later, John crossed under Interstate 4 and turned left onto Huey Street and gazed down the road to the OPD headquarters. "My God," he said to himself. He stared at dozens of vehicles a quarter mile away, many moving about, mostly large yellow school buses and Humvees, even a few modern MRAPs. They were clustered in front of the old headquarter building, parked end to end under the I-4 overpass parking spaces that sat across from headquarters. Several buses idled on the street, their accordion doors open and engines spewing diesel smoke into the air. All at once, civilization seemed not so far away. It was with a lighter step that John rapidly walked to the front of the building to present his credentials to a guard that stood watch. Before he could reach the stairs to the front door, two DHS agents in full military gear appeared from behind one of the idling buses and brought their M4 rifles to bear on the policeman. "Halt!" one man cried. "Drop your weapons now!" John forgot he was in civilian clothing and quickly dropped to his knees. He unslung the shotgun from his shoulder and laid it on the ground. He raised both hands high in the air and replied, "John Drosky, OPD, reporting for duty," he shouted. The DHS agents were in black military gear. A police morale patch was stuck to his Velcro identifier on the front of their plate carriers. They were in full kit with Kevlar helmet, a battle belt with full load out of 5.56 ammunition, a sidearm with two spare magazines rounded out the firepower. On their shoulders were the DHS patch he had learned to recognize over the years of federal and local interaction. John didn't move a muscle. Both agents approached Drosky and covered him. They eventually took his shotgun and pistol from his holster. They finally frisked him and zip-tied his hands behind his back. "We'll have to check this out," one of them said. "Stay seated while we verify your identification." One of them, the older of the two, went into the building with John's identification while the other stood guard. The younger one, younger than John by his looks, bounced back and forth on his heels as he stood guard over his prisoner. "Don't worry," the young agent said. "We just need to make sure you are who you say you are." "No big deal," John replied. "I get it. I could have capped John Drosky and taken his weapon and ID, no problem." The agent seemed to relax a bit, his rocking motion steadied. But John noted that he wasn't well trained. For starters, the young man failed to keep an eye on his surroundings while his partner was in the building. In an amateurish sort of way, it felt like the kid was playing soldier and not well versed at his job. He glanced at a few women that passed by, trying to strike up a conversation with one attractive girl. As the minutes passed, he even stopped watching John and fumbled in his pocket for some dip. Retrieving a can of Skol, he actually put his rifle butt down on the ground, leaning it against his legs so he could use both hands to place the cut tobacco between his cheek and gums. He actually had the barrel of his firearm pointing up at his body, effectively putting his head in the line of fire. Instructors called that lasing, as if you were pointing a laser at someone or something not meant to be pointed at with your rifle. It was inexcusable, but given the state of things, John chalked it up to desperation and situation. You take what is available and use it to the best of your abilities. DHS was using the assets they could. John took pity on the kid and got his attention. "Hey, kid," he said in a low voice. The young man turned to look at John, who still sat on the sidewalk. "No one gave you permission to talk," he stammered back, the military rifle still butt down on the ground, its barrel pointing up at his chin as it leaned on his leg. "No offense, but you need to be more careful where you point your rifle." "What the hell are you talking about? I can point it wherever I want." "I mean," John softly replied in his most gentle and non-threatening tone, "don't let your CO see you with your rifle like that. You're lazing yourself." "What do you mean?" the kid asked. John's concerned parent voice, the one he used to defuse situations on the street, seemed to disarm the young man. "You know," John replied, "lazing, pointing the barrel at something you don't want to kill or break." The kid gave him a perplexed look. So John continued. My God, John thought, how deep in the hole did DHS have to go to get this kid? "You know," John replied, "in your firearm training, never point the barrel of the gun at friends. It's one of the four rules of firearm safety." The kid still looked lost, so John finally laid it out for him. "Kid," he stated in his stern father voice, "look down at your rifle. Where the hell is the barrel pointing?" The young DHS agent looked down at his firearm and stared directly into the loaded chamber of his own battle rifle. "Holy shit!" he cried, and brought the firearm back to his low ready position, barrel pointing slightly down and slightly away from John. "That's what I'm talking about," John said in his concerned voice. "I just didn't want anything to happen to you." The young man was momentarily embarrassed, a red flush rising in his cheeks. Cripes, John thought. Is this kid Cherry or what? "Don't worry about it, kid. The world is upside down. It's easy to lose track of your training when all hell breaks loose. In a bit, it'll come back. Always does, as long as your sergeants keep track of you." The young man shuffled his feet, failing to make eye contact with John. It was an awkward moment that seemed to last for minutes. In reality, some few seconds later, another bus pulled in front of the building, disgorging a number of workers and DHS agents. "John?" Drosky heard from the sidewalk to his right. John looked over and saw one of the OPD dispatchers where she had stopped on the walkway. Tanya Culverson was known for her cool demeanor under pressure. All the officers recognized her when her voice came over the radio. She rarely sent the police into a situation without thoroughly wringing every last bit of information from the caller. It was a difficult and delicate job. She needed to balance the urgency of the call with the need for vital information, information that could help the officers catch the bad guys and, most importantly, keep the OPD officers alive. John was glad she had made it. "What the hell's going on here?" she stated to the DHS agent. "That man is OPD and a hell of an officer. Just what's going on here?" The young agent didn't know what to do. he was in a horrible spot with several OPD employees who were already cleared and back working in the building, standing behind Tanya, lending their support. Before things got any further out of hand, John shouted over them, "Hey, enough! The kid's doing his job. They're following protocol." "Well, let me tell you," Tanya shot back, "their protocol sucks. I've been here from the beginning, and they are doing things that just don't make sense. And they sure as hell aren't letting OPD make any decisions." "I'm fine, and he's doing what he's supposed to do," John replied, in his "I appreciate it" voice. "Now really, I've been out in this shit for 6 days. A few minutes sitting in the morning sun won't hurt me. I'll see you all inside and we can catch up." "I'll be waiting," Tanya shot back, giving the young man a glare that could have killed. "Look me up in transportation and relocation." "What? Transportation and relocation of who?" "That, Officer John Drosky, is the $64 question. We'll talk, honey. Oh yeah, we're going to do a lot of talking." And with that, the group moved on to the entrance. "Thanks, guys," John shouted at them, receiving a wave from two of the members as they disappeared into the glass front doors. "Thanks, man," the young agent said. "Hey, you got a tough job here. Just stay frosty. You can't let your guard down when you're on the front line." A few minutes later, the older agent returned, and the two led John to the lobby. Multiple desks had been set up, and signs lorded over different areas. Relocation services, transportation, intra-agency coordination, re-education services, and other monikers. John did a double take on the last one. "Re-education," he said to himself. "What the hell is that?" They led him to the chief of police's office, where a new group of employees were stationed. Gone were the old workers, replaced by DHS employees. The chief's name was still mounted over the door, but a paper banner had been taped over it. It read, "Director of DHS Services." They entered the room, and John, hands still zip-tied behind his back, was led to one of 20 or so modules where a severe and rough-looking woman of indeterminate age stared back at him. The two agents spoke in hushed whispers to her, while John stood ramrod straight, 10 feet back, staring at the divider wall above the seated woman's head. She wore no uniform, but commanded the two agents to cut his tie and dismiss them from her presence like a drill sergeant, crushing the spirit out of a new recruit. She looked at the paperwork in front of her, taking her time while John maintained his stance. After a bit, she put the folder down and addressed the OPD officer.
"John Drosky," she started, "I'm surprised it took you so long to report."
Her tone of voice left no doubt that she wasn't happy with the delay in getting back after 6 days of absence.
"May I speak freely?" John asked.
He had decided that it was best to placate the new bosses, act like the loyal Marine he once was, and always would be, and give these people some respect for responding so quickly to the emergency. The organization he saw here after only 6 days was next to miraculous, given the federal government and its past history of cluelessness and ineffective execution of even the most basic functions. What John saw was a well-oiled emergency response. It was surprising and welcome.
"Go on,"
the woman simply replied. John went on to describe his final call and the discovery of the bodies, the loss of power, and his 5 days of trying to organize the people of the neighborhood. He concluded with his walk back and his surprise at the level of response.
"If I may say so," John concluded, "I am surprised with the federal response I've seen here. Very impressive. I hope I can help out."
The woman seemed to soften a bit with his last statement. Her eyes, ice cold the entire time, warmed slightly, and she began to tap her pencil on the closed manila folder, which held the summary of John's life. Everything from his grade school transcript, how in the heck did they get those?
to his last field reports were in the paperwork. He was stunned to see such a massive amount of data on him already collected. More data than the OPD had in his personal file. It was remarkable. Both of my agents reported that you were cooperative and even helpful in defusing a situation outside, she stated. She then continued, I see you have no political party affiliation. Is that true?
True, ma'am.
You don't like politicians, Officer Drosky, she said with a bit of sarcasm.
I just don't pay attention to politics, ma'am. I don't find it interesting or relevant to my day-to-day life, he replied, somewhat perplexed.
Why is that important? He asked himself.
I see that you don't own any personal firearms, is that correct? She continued.
No, ma'am. My duty weapon is more than sufficient for my job.
He once again replied. And may I ask, why is that important?
John asked in his innocent voice.
Her eyes flared with the questioning, but softened when she saw John's easygoing demeanor.
Just taking inventory, officer, trying to keep the public safe.
John waited stoically for her to continue. She reopened her voluminous folder and scanned several more pages. Multiple colored tabs were used to divide what looked to be an over 2-inch-thick dossier. Finally, she closed the folder once again and addressed the OPD officer.
I see that you are a Marine, Officer Drosky.
We like to consider ourselves Marines for life, ma'am, but yes, I was a Marine.
And as a Marine, your job was...
To follow orders, ma'am. That seemed to please her. The woman set the folder aside and produced two envelopes. She set aside the dark blue envelope and gave John a white one.
Officer Drosky, thank you for your patience. Please go to your right through the glass door marked Intake 1. Take that hallway and follow the instructions you will find
in the envelope I gave you.
Go, and welcome back.
John nodded to the woman and gathered his backpack. His weapons were never returned to him, but he was sure that was going to be corrected
once he was settled in.
As John walked away and around to the right, he found two doors against the far wall. The first one was marked Intake 2, and the one just past it marked Intake 1. As he walked in the front of the first door, Intake 2, he bumped into a sheriff's deputy he had interacted with during his time on the force. He couldn't quite remember the deputy's name, but the large and surly man was grumbling under his breath as he pushed by John and went through the Intake 2 portal. John noticed that he had carried a blue envelope with him.
Curious, John thought.
There's a lot that doesn't make sense here. Then Officer Drosky exited through the Intake 1 door. Pushing aside his doubts in the hopes of taking care of some of his more basic needs, like a hot shower and a good meal, his stomach rumbled when he smelled bacon cooking somewhere down the hall. It had been a long 5 days, and John was sure things could only get better with the level of organization he saw in front of him. Food and a hot shower. Those were his primary concerns right now, along with the over 2 million other souls in the Orlando metropolitan area.
Chapter 17, Day 6, Charlie, Kirkman Specialty Clinic.
Dr. Kramer removed the two corpses, putting them with the third one on the side of the building. Janice mopped up the blood, and everyone took turns in the hot shower. We were all preparing to leave, and hot water might not be available for a while. The patients were given first dibs in the doctor's private lavatory. All five were elderly and seemed to take forever in the bathroom. Dr. Kramer had decided to drive the five patients and Peg to their homes, then make his way back to his family farm in Montverde. Janice and Garrett and I were going to walk to DeLand.
That's a heck of a walk, Garrett said, as they loaded up the additional supplies from the dumpster into the captured Chevy.
The stash of medications had been somewhat of a surprise. Of course, the narcotics were the first thing the crooks had taken, but most pharmacies Only keep a day or two of any medication on hand for sale. The drugs the punks had been searching for just aren't kept in high volume. It wasn't just for security's sake, but rather a financial decision. Just-in-time inventories had revolutionized profits in almost every industry in America. Daily deliveries kept overhead costs low and short-term profits high. Unfortunately for the newly collapsed American people, that meant just a 2 or 3 day supply of food was on hand when the lights went out. It was day 6 and people were already hungry. But what pleased Dr. Kramer was the other medications he found. The criminals had actually taken all the drugs in the pharmacy, not just the party drugs, and Dr. Kramer planned to use those to help his community. Heart and blood pressure meds were in the trunk, along with antibiotics and even prescription-strength NSAIDs, like Motrin and Aleve. The whole pharmacy was in there. Combined with Dr. Kramer's stash of samples, he would be able to help a lot of people for a very long time. Garrett was stuck with a pillowcase for a knapsack, lacking a backpack to carry his walking supplies. Janice lightheartedly needled him about looking like a little boy running away from home, with his pillowcase tied to an unused IV pole. The poor kid, actually we found out during our conversations that he was almost 22, was crestfallen. But Janice felt guilty after that and did her best to prop up his self-esteem with some reminders of how he had saved us all the prior evening. Young men, even the brave ones, can have an awfully fragile ego. Dr. Kramer heard the kerfuffle about the knapsack and appeared with a pair of jeans. "Whose jeans are those?" I asked. "Donated," he replied, and nodded toward the side staff entrance. That's where he took the bodies of the 3 thugs. He got some string that he called paracord, and tied off the bottom of the pant legs, sealing them shut. He left 2 long loose ends on each tied-off leg, and then brought each of them up to the waistband and tied each end of the leg onto one of the belt loops. When he held it up, he had created a homemade backpack. The 2 pant legs were now shoulder straps, and the waist opening was the mouth of the pack. "Don't worry," the doctor said. "He isn't going to need this anymore." Garrett gave him a disgusted look. "And yes, I smelled them first. I think they're newly stolen. There's no smell to them." We all chuckled a little too morbidly. It was disturbing. We loaded up what we now called the denim backpack with Garrett's supplies, and Dr. Kramer used more paracord to fasten together some of the belt loops from the front loop to back loop, effectively sealing off most of the top. He made an X between 4 of the loops in the middle of the pack, 2 in the front of the pants, and 2 in the back. He then tied the 2 loose ends together with a shoe tie so Garrett could easily open and close his makeshift rucksack, making it quite effective. "Take this," Dr. Kramer said. "This is a spare belt. You can use it as a chest strap to cinch the leg straps together in the front. It'll keep the sack riding high on your back and a lot more comfortable." Janice smirked. "What's so funny?" Dr. Kramer asked. Janice began to giggle, then snort as she fought to hold in her laughter. Finally, she blurted it out. "I never thought I'd hear you worried about another man's sack riding high and comfortable." We all just looked at her, stunned. And as one, including Dr. Kramer, we had the best laugh I could remember in a very long time. It seemed to last forever, and it was the greatest medicine I could have ever been given. All of a sudden, our situation didn't seem so bad. It was, pardon the pun, just what the doctor ordered. Dr. Kramer brought me, Janice, and Garrett into his private office while the patients gathered their belongings and took them to the car outside. "Well," he said, "I guess this is it. I wish I could say it's been a pleasure, but I can say I'm proud of the way you 3 handled yourselves. You were the perfect end-of-the-world companions." We all giggled and got down to a more serious discussion. The doctor opened his desk drawer and withdrew the 3 handguns we inherited when our invaders were killed the prior evening. "Do any of you have firearm training?" he asked. "I do," I replied. "My dad took me to the range a number of times, but I haven't shot a gun in a few years." He grabbed a black pistol and unloaded it by racking the slide back, ejecting the bullet in the chamber, locking it in place, and ejecting the magazine. He handed me the handgun. "It's a High Point 9mm, he stated. "It's heavy and has a stiff trigger, but it's reliable and won't let you down. It holds 8 bullets in the magazine and 1 in the chamber." I hefted the firearm and disengaged the slide lock, which was the same button as the safety. Interesting. The slide snapped forward, and I held the heavy handgun up in front of me, lining up the sights on the staff-only sign attached to his bathroom door. I grabbed the magazine and put it back in the pistol, racked the slide, which put a bullet in the chamber, and ejected the magazine once again. I put the previously ejected bullet back in the magazine and replaced it in the pistol. "This will do," I said. "It's heavy, but I like the feel of it. Like my dad used to say, more mass, less recoil." "Well," Dr. Kramer said, "that's a great idea when you're at the range. But you have a lot of miles to cover, and that gun is nearly 2 pounds. Can you do it?" "I'm a Gator, Dr. Kramer," I said, reminding him of my collegiate days. "I can do anything." "Oh, please," Janice shot back. "If you ever do one of those god-awful gator chomps with your arms, I promise I will snap you in half." "Roll Tide," I replied with a grin. "Okay, okay, that's quite enough," the doctor said with a grin. "How about you, Janice? Do you know how to handle a firearm?" "Sorry, Dr. Kramer. In my family, the boys did the hunting and the women did the cooking. I suppose I could use one if I had to, but I would prefer to let someone else do that." "Suit yourself," he replied. "How about you, Garrett?" "I can handle a pistol," he replied. Dr. Kramer had a revolver and another black handgun on the table. Garrett picked up the black pistol and properly removed and replaced the magazine. He kept the firearm pointed away from all in the room as he manipulated the slide to gently pull it back a bit and confirm that a bullet was in the chamber. "It's a Glock," he said. "It's a .40 caliber," Dr. Kramer said. "It's got a 13-round magazine, and I found a spare mag in the car along with 2 boxes of ammo, 1 for each pistol." Dr. Kramer took the revolver and put it in his pocket. "Well, I've got my hunter right here," Janice said in her sweet southern accent. Garrett smiled, turned, and left the room. "I've got 1 or 2 more things to pack," he said, as he made his way to the reception room. "I'm with him, too," Janice said, and quickly followed. "Looks like Janice found her man," Dr. Kramer said, after the 2 had left the room. "But he's too young," I replied. "She's almost 5 years older than him." "He's a man," Dr. Kramer said in earnest. "In this new world, you'll find out soon enough that age isn't going to determine the men from the boys. Garrett killed 2 dangerous people for you guys, especially for Janice. Not many men out there in today's society that could or would do that." He was right, I thought. Just how many guys in my generation could have done what Garrett did last night? Who could you rely on in this upside-down world? Garrett had proven himself. As I watched the 2 of them work together down the hall in the waiting room, I realized that they were quickly becoming a couple. I envied them. Going through the apocalypse with a partner would make things much easier. I thought I had a battle buddy in Janice, but now I wasn't so sure. She needed protection. I wanted a partner. 30 minutes later, we helped the patients into the vehicle. The car was loaded with food, medical supplies, and other gear that the 6 would use to survive the coming weeks. Dr. Kramer had a long coil of IV tubing wrapped around his waist in the event he needed to siphon gasoline. It was both cute and sad at the same time. We hugged and kissed each other, acting like the day after Thanksgiving when all the relatives were heading home. It was a bittersweet time. We all knew that we wouldn't be seeing each other again. Dr. Kramer handed me a paper bag just before he got into the driver's seat.
"Here, Charlie, take these. They are for you and Janice."
I looked inside the bag, and it was filled with birth control pills. I looked up and smiled.
"Gosh, Doc, I didn't know you thought of me that way."
He chuckled and put on a serious face.
"Charlie, you don't want to be pregnant out there right now. It's not going to be a place to raise a baby. Just take these and start using them if you aren't on them already. I hate to think of bearing a child in this mess."
"It's all right, Doc. I don't have a boyfriend."
"Maybe not now," he replied.
And in a grave whisper, he said,
"And maybe you run into a situation where you didn't want to get pregnant, or worse, a time when you didn't want to have sex."
I got his drift. My mood quickly turned serious. Getting pregnant because I wasn't careful was stupid. Getting raped may not be a choice. I shivered, and Dr. Kramer grabbed me in his arms and hugged me. It was a father's hug. I needed it.
"Now," he said to the group, "it's time to get out of here."
He looked at the three of us and pointed down the road past the I-4 overpass.
"There's a bike shop down there and a Walmart further still. But I would stay away from any store that could have food, liquor, drugs, or firearms. There'll be a death trap someday, if not already. Each of you need to get a bike however you can, by hook or crook. It will make your trip a lot quicker and maybe safer. And find a map if you can."
With a quick wave, the good doctor jumped into the driver's seat, cranked the engine, and was gone. Janice started to tear up as the big blue Chevy rumbled down to Kirkman Road, made a right, and shot north to begin delivering his patients to their homes. I sighed, and as the quiet began to settle in, I realized that I felt a lot less sure of myself now that he was gone. I felt small and frail for the first time in a long while. With Dr. Kramer gone, I became very aware that I missed my family, and most of all, I missed my dad. I wanted to go home. Chapter 18, Day 6, 33rd Street Jail. Mike Jones was glad it was nearly over. The past 5 days hadn't gone well. With the power gone and over 4,000 angry inmates yelling, cursing, and throwing feces at him, he had just about had enough of the place. If it weren't for his brother officers, he likely would have split some inmate heads. And there had been a lot of that going on. Not the COs banging heads, but the gangs taking on each other, at least for the first 3 days. They had done their best to keep the gang members separated throughout the ordeal. But with no computers available to track the prisoner's location in the complex, more often than not, competing gangs would inadvertently meet in the exercise yard or cafeteria. Almost always, blood was drawn. Things were bleak, and rumors that the food supply was dwindling didn't leave the correction officers with much hope. 3 days earlier, the warden released about 700 prisoners that were considered non-violent or within 6 months of release. They were drawing up a second list when miracle of miracles happened. The federal government showed up. A convoy of military vehicles pulled up to the front gates, and rumor had it that they were going to be absorbing the facility into the federal government. In fact, the commander of the DHS unit had been taken to meet with the various gang leaders, and within a day of his arrival, and the gang violence trickled to a halt. Mike didn't know how they did it,
nor did he care.
But the last 2 days had been blissfully quiet, and the feds, or DHS, or someone with some serious pull had actually brought out a working generator, allowing them to restart the muffin monster and clear the sewage from their pipes. There was even a shower available for the brass that ran hot water. And the food problem disappeared overnight. Mike had to admit it, the feds came through with flying colors. Just then, his radio crackled to life. "Officer Mike Jones, report to the warden's office." Mike keyed back and replied. He would be there in 10 minutes. Mike had been sleeping in the work release center, where the guards had taken over the facility. The center, designed like a dormitory, allowed for prisoners to work in the community, then return to jail at night. It provided them with a chance to pull their own weight by earning an income to support their own family, pay victim restitution, and reimburse the government for fees and prosecution. All these work center prisoners were low risk and had been released, freeing up space for the guards that had stayed to do their jobs. Overall, over 50% of the staff stood their ground. Mikey was proud of that. He thought it would have been a lot worse. Mike entered the warden's office, where a new group of administrators had set up shop. Several desks were present, with DHS employees manning each one. Mike must have had a confused look on his face, because one of the administrators shouted out, "Can I help you?" he yelled. "Mike Jones reporting as requested." "Oh, yes," one of the other desk jockeys said. "Right over here." Mike took a seat in front of the man while he reviewed a thick folder in front of him. "Oh, easy enough," the man gushed. "You're scheduled to go to OPD headquarters, where you'll be reassigned by our department there. They are processing all the corrections officers at their facilities." The man took Mike's incredibly thick personnel file and placed it in a self-sealing envelope. It reminded Mike of the large white, tear-resistant envelopes the post office uses for first-class mail, the ones with the green border. "Now you can take this with you and report to the Orlando Police Department headquarters building at 100 South Huey Avenue," the man continued. "There is a bus service at the front gate that leaves on the hour. You have to report by midnight tonight." "Do I have to wait until then?" Mike asked. He was scheduled for another night shift, but that was obviously not happening if he had to report to OPD headquarters tonight. "No, whenever you are ready," he concluded. "Anything else?" the man asked. As Mike sat and tried to assimilate his new orders, Mike shook his head. "Then go! Be off! The next bus leaves in 45 minutes and another an hour later." Mike got up to leave, but was stopped when the man handed him the envelope with his records in it. The man, a bit on the eerie side, refused to let go of the package when Mike first took hold. He tugged back hard as Mike attempted to leave. "Under no circumstances are you to open this package. If you do, it is a federal crime punishable by imprisonment of at least 5 years." Mike snickered, thinking the man was pulling his leg. But one look at the bureaucrat told Michael James Jones that there was no humor in his words. "Seriously?" Michael shot back. "Officer Jones," the man sneered back, "don't fuck with the DHS. Not now, nor in the immediate future. Be advised, we aren't screwing around." Mike shook his head in amazement and lumbered off to pack his belongings and catch the next bus. It had been a strange few days, but regardless of the lack of civility of the new front office people, he was glad they were there and elated that he could leave. He wanted to check up on his mother and two sisters, so he just had to report in tonight and find some downtime to make sure the family was safe. His family lived north outside of Sanford and had a little land where his mama raised chickens, rabbits, and had a nice garden. He knew that with her stores of canned and jarred food, they would be all right for now. And his mama and the sisters knew how to use a gun, having a shotgun and pistol available to protect their home. They had good neighbors too, so Mikey wasn't worried yet. Looking at the activity around him, it appeared that the corner had been turned. He would just check in, get his new assignment, and take some time to see his family. Maybe, he thought, I might even convince Mama to put one of her older birds into a pot and cook a nice homemade chicken dinner. That thought finally brought a grin to the big man's face, the first one in 6 days. It felt good to finally smile again. About a half an hour later, Mike found his way to the bus tagged to deliver its passengers to the OPD headquarters. With less than 4 miles of roadway to travel, it shouldn't take too long. But then again, with the stalled cars and lack of power still evident, there was no way to know how long any travel would take. Looking down the road, Mike could see a stream of people coming off the I-4 ramp, heading away from the jail to the north. The numbers were surprising. Hundreds of people were walking along the side of the road, coming down the far ramp and continuing north on the roadway. The flow seemed endless.
"That's a lot of mouths to feed," came a retort next to him.
Mike looked down and thought he recognized the woman standing next to him. Unsure who she was, he replied back,
"True dat. I haven't seen that many people since the last Florida Classic football game."
"The Cats really took it to the Rattlers, didn't they?" she replied. The big man looked down on the little white woman and gave her a very quizzical look.
"Get back, girl," he said with a smile. "You watch that game?"
"Every year," she replied.
"But it's BCC and A&M.
They're black schools, and you definitely are not black."
"So," she replied, "I watch for the battle of the bands and the cheerleaders. I don't care who you are. That's fun to watch."
"Huh," Mikey snorted. "Never would have thought," he said to himself.
"Name's Beth. Beth Ann Hildreth," she said to him,
and stuck out her little hand. The big guy gently took her hand in his and replied,
"Mike, Mike Jones."
"So, Mike Jones, I assume you're a corrections officer?"
"Yes, ma'am, and I assume you're not."
The little woman rang out an infectious giggle.
"No, sir. No, I am not."
"Didn't think so. You don't have that look."
"What look?"
she deftly lobbed back.
Their verbal sparring was becoming fun. "You're saying I look a little too mean for the job?"
"Well," Mike shot back, enjoying the direction of the conversation,
"I didn't want to bring that up, but since you've mentioned it."
"Watch it, Buster," she chided back. "Big guys like you have no defense for my quick, cat-like strikes."
"Hi-ya!"
And she jumped into an exaggerated karate stance, staring up at the giggling giant next to her.
"I'm glad you recognize my superior powers, Mr. Mike, before I was forced to use them on you. I can assure you, it would have been extremely embarrassing."
"Okay, I give up. You are the sensei," Mike snorted at her.
"And I will call you Grasshopper," Beth replied.
"Grasshopper?" Mike genuinely asked. "Why Grasshopper?"
"You know, Kung Fu, the old television show."
"Never heard of it," Mike honestly said.
"Must be a white thing."
"Nah," Beth said. "More generational. I could be your mother."
"Hmm," Mike said back.
He stared north at the walking hordes moving away from them up John Young Parkway, away from the jail. He pointed at them, and Beth looked where he directed.
"The way the world looks now," he said, "I don't know if I'll ever learn what you're talking about."
Beth stared up the road, watching the mass of people stagger and slog their way along the 4-lane street.
"True dat, big man," she replied back. "True dat."
Chapter 19. Day 6. Charlie on the road. I strapped my book bag over my shoulders and quickly realized that jogging and CrossFit weren't the same as hiking with a load on my back. I suppose I shouldn't have been surprised at the revelation. I mean, even in swimming, being a star at the 50-meter freestyle didn't translate to fame and fortune in water polo. They were two completely different events, even though they were both in the water. You would think that a medalist in the SEC championships my junior and senior year could allow me to throw a damn volleyball in the water for a full game. But when I tried once, just because it looked fun, I lasted exactly 16 minutes, 2/4 of the 4-quarter match, before I gave up. These guys have to tread water dash back and forth the length of the pool, and rise up several feet like a freaking whale breaching the surface of the ocean. And they do it nonstop for 8-minute stints, 4 times in a row. I assumed they were the same muscles I used when I did my 50 and 100-meter freestyle sprints, but I quickly found out they really aren't. Water polo was a constant grind, while freestyle sprinting lasted less than a minute, with hours between competitions. I was a world-class sprinter in swimming's version of a marathon. Now, with the prospect of having to lug 30 pounds across miles of hostile land, I was quickly being reminded of this reality. The best way to get in shape for a particular physical event or test is to practice that event. I was a jogger, wearing the minimal amount of clothing and lightest shoes when I did it. Now only an hour into our journey, I was carrying almost 30 pounds of food, clothing, water, and a damn heavy handgun, and feeling it in muscles I didn't realize I had. And worst of all, we were still wandering about just south of the office, looking for bicycles, and hadn't started north to Janice's sister's house. What was also taking its toll was the stress. Walking wasn't just a stroll now. We had to plan our steps, literally every step, so that we could cover each other, avoid possible traps and choke points, and all the while try to stay unnoticed. The people who were out now tended to be a bit desperate. With 6 days of hell behind us, the desperate, stupid, and criminal tended to be the boldest. I hoped we were in the first category and not the second. Of course, we had killed 3 men, so technically, we did fit the third category. When we finally found the bicycle shop, it had been looted. I suppose it shouldn't have been a surprise with the hotels and theme parks nearby. Anyone with a home 500 miles or less from here would have been looking for any transportation to get home. Unless we wanted to take a child's pink Barbie bike, of which there were many left in the ransacked shop, we were now committed to our lot in life. Foot refugees. At least we only had 50 or 60 miles to walk. Her sister's property was about 10 miles northwest of DeLand, which was about as rural as you could find in crowded central Florida. One big positive was our discovery of a map of the bicycle trails in central Florida. Not having been into bicycling, I was surprised at the number and extent of the trails throughout the state. Janice and Garrett cleared a table and we laid the map down. The early morning sun was shining into the broken storefront window, giving us a nice warm light to see by. After studying the map for a bit, I realized that we could use several of these trails to pass through many parts of the city while staying off the main roads.